Pet station number 10657, reel 16.
Major Lewis, reel 16. You're explaining about how Montgomery placed great emphasis on night operations,
yes,
and clearing mines.
Yes.
That's about the time you got back to Mariupolis.
To Mariupolis, yes. We got back there where we just got C Company and Headquarter Company and a new B Company, which I think had been made up mainly from 100 other ranks. Six officers and 100 other ranks had arrived at Mariupolis, and most of them had made up the new B Company. And from there, we went 10 miles south of Amarillo to the area of the main RAF landing grounds as part of a mobile reserve.
This was a new role for you, wasn't it?
Yes. We didn't actually get involved in anything, because shortly afterwards we came under 9th Armoured Brigade, moved south of the landing ground area to prevent the enemy reaching the airfields if the line, the Alamein line, was breached in the south. Had it been breached in the south, they would obviously have gone for the airfields, and therefore we had a quite different role to one we'd ever had before, a mobile reserve that could be rushed up to defend the airfields.
Did this mean then that you were having to contemplate close cooperation with tanks for the first time?
It doesn't say anything about tanks at all. Although, wait a minute, 9th Armoured Brigade, yes. 9th Armoured Brigade we would have done. So I would have met, although I can't recollect this, because I don't think there was very much time to do any training with them, because on August the 30th, Rommel attacked, and the main attack came in the south, where he turned up towards the Alamel Health Bridge when he'd broken through. So we were only sort of attached to the 9th Armoured Brigade for a few days.
Do you remember having anything to do with them?
No, I don't actually. All this happened, as I can make up, between the 22nd of August and the 30th of August, over 8 days from the time we left Mariupolis until the time Rommel attacked. And I think any tanks that had been around I would have thought we probably stayed where we were whilst this was going on, because I think Montgomery was pretty certain that Rommel would turn towards the Alamel Helfer Ridge, which is exactly what he did. So the landing grounds were not, in fact, threatened.
But you do mention parachute attack. Was that taken seriously as a possibility?
Don't remember that one at all. Parachute attack, or the possibility of a parachute attack on the landing grounds, yes, I think that was taken seriously, all right. But I don't really think there doesn't appear to be very much time that we had to do anything to sort of get prepared. I don't remember we weren't putting stakes out on the landing grounds or anything, because they were still being used by our own planes. It's a bit of a hazy period that, actually.
But you got back from Middle East Training Centre and found that B Company had gone into the bag at Ruin
That's
Ridge.
Right.
So what did they do with you?
When I got back to Mariupolis?
Yes.
Well, I don't think I went back to B Company. Sure I didn't, because I mean there was another. I wasn't commanding a company at that time. I think I went back to C Company, actually, and I don't think this happened until we got up into the Alamein line again. Well, not again, until we actually went up into the line. Don't think I went back to B Company. I can't recollect, actually.
Do you remember what C Company was like, whether they were different in any way from B Company.
Well, C Company, I think, was probably made up of the original regulars, you know, the original battalion, whereas B Company was an entirely new company altogether.
Were the new B Company men from Durham?
No, I shouldn't think so. I don't think so. I don't think we... I wouldn't have thought that we got very many replacements from Durham, actually, after the original arrival in the Middle East. I don't think we got a lot.
Did this cause any sort of difficulty with them settling in and becoming a part of the battalion?
No, I think they did very well, really. I mean, they they settled down pretty well under very, very different conditions to any they'd ever had before, alongside chaps who'd been there and been involved in this sort of warfare for a long time. So really, I think they did very well indeed. And I think they acquitted themselves very well very soon afterwards when we became involved in the Alamein and the Alamein battle. You know, there was always a certain amount of, you know, people were always pretty fed up if they found themselves posted to a unit other than their own. But at the same time, if they realised when they got into that unit that the officers knew what they were doing, and that the troops were not dissatisfied with the way their officers looked after them, they thought to themselves, well, we've got a pretty good billet here, you know, we may as well settle down here. Why worry about trying to get back to our own regiment, which they could rarely succeed in doing anyway.
Do you have any recollection of what you were doing in C Company? What your...
Not until I got into the... we got into the line, actually.
And was that down in the south?
Yes, that was down in the south. You see, Rommel attacked August the 30th, turned towards the LML Helfer Ridge when he'd broken through, where the German attacks were well and truly broken up. On September the 3rd, he called off the attack, and this is considered to be when the final bid for Cairo had failed, and for the British and Dominion forces in Africa, it was considered to be the turning point of the war, and also one of the most decisive defensive battles that had been fought so far in World War II. That's the Alam Helfer battle, which in fact was planned entirely by, I say entirely, but almost entirely by General Montgomery. So on September the 4th, although 50 Div had not been involved, the DLI brigade had moved into the line to take up positions vacated by the New Zealand division. So a few days, the day after Rommel called off his attack, we moved in to the southern sector of the Alamein line and took over the reserve in a reserve area of the line from the 28th Māori New Zealand Battalion. The takeover was late at night, and I remember we went on a recce during the afternoon to have a look at the area before we actually moved in there that night.
What was the area like?
Well, it was, I think, the dirtiest area we'd ever had to take over from anybody at any time during the war. I mean, nobody's disputing the fact that the Māoris were first-rate troops, but the area was absolutely foul, and we'd never occupied an area so neglected in sanitary and refuse arrangements. There were flies, innumerable flies, heaps of refuse all over the place which had been left in the open. There was a danger, an ever-present danger of dysentery. And we reckon it took 50% of the battalion to clear up the area, and another 50% to improve the defences, which meant digging and improving the positions that had been vacated by the Maras. Even the refuse that they'd borrowed, that they'd buried slightly below the surface, when you walked over it, it was spongy. It was almost on the top, and it was an absolutely ghastly area, and we couldn't understand how troops of that sort of calibre could leave an area like that, because the Germans never left an area like that. Even the Italians didn't, and we certainly never did, and we'd never come across this before. So I mean, we were pretty browned off about it all, in actual fact, because a hell of a lot of work was involved in digging all this stuff up and burning it, and absolutely a stinking area, in actual fact. So we weren't too happy about the Maras, but we were to have them on our right during supercharge, when they were quite fantastic, and as I'll explain then, we're only supposed to go a certain distance, and were doing so well that they dug deep into the German defences when they should in actual fact have been staying put and waiting for the next stage. They were marvellous fighting men, marvellous. In fact, the New Zealand Division, in my opinion, was the best infantry division in the Middle East. They were fine troops.
What you mentioned, improving the defences, did this mean digging them deeper?
Having just moved in, don't forget this was a reserve company area, so it's really a question of digging slit trenches a bit deeper, just in case you get any odd German bombers over or something like that. But we weren't at that stage digging a complete complex of trenches, which we were later to do when we actually moved into the Alamein line.
How long were you there then in this reserve?
We were there from the next few days, because on the 9th, September the 9th, we actually moved into the line. But prior to that, on the 6th and the evening of the 6th, we went out on a reconnaissance. The CO was in the carrier, and I was in the carrier, so that by that time it looks as though I'd probably been made up to company commander. And Captain English of C Company and Captain Beattie of A Company. And we're back to September the 6th, I think, where we went out on a reconnaissance in one of the 8th Battalion carriers. There was the Colonel Jackson, myself. I think by then I'd been made commander of B Company, Captain English, who was C Company, and Captain Beattie, who was A Company. We were going through a minefield gap that had been reported clear by the sappers, and the carrier went up on a mine. Fortunately, we were none of us injured. It blew the track off the carrier. But what I do very clearly remember was that the explosion sent a lot of sand up into the air, and the sand came plopping down on us wet, because the sand under the desert is wet and cold, and you had the horrible feeling for a moment that people were being blown up and bits and pieces of them were descending on you. And we were all splayed over the edges of this carrier, and this sand was pouring down on us for what seemed an eternity. Anyway, when we came round and realised that we were all in one piece and none of us had been hurt at all, except the track had blown off, we heard somebody shouting to us to stay where we were, and it was a New Zealand battalion commander who was a friend of Colonel Jackson's. He came running up the tracks of the carrier, which was the safest thing to do, and he'd only gone a few yards when he went up on a mine. What had happened was that the carrier tracks had only disturbed the mine, and when he put his extra pressure on, it set it off, because he was blown, cured in front of us. And then, of course, we stayed where we were, and I don't know which infantry there were in that particular area, that the platoon was immediately whistled up to probe through the gap until they reached us and we were able to get out and walk back. But that was a tragic thing to happen, really. More tragic when you realise that not one other mine was found by the probing.
How did they probe? With bayonets?
Bayonets. Yes, you go along on your knees and you just probe. This is the best way of clearing a minefield. You probe until the bayonet hits metal. And then you clear the sand around it, and depending on the situation, if you're moving forward all the time, you mark it with a little stick or something, or something sticking up to indicate where it is, and then somebody else will pick it up. Some other saddles will pick it up. But in this particular case, it was only a fairly narrow minefield gap, and had they found anything, they'd have taken them away. But the tragedy of it was that one mine had blown the carrier up, another had blown this New Zealand colonel up, and there were no other mines there.
How far beneath the surface were they normally buried?
Depended who'd put them in. Not very far. You'd come on a mine if you went down as deep as that.
So it'd be about 8 inches?
Yes, no, I should have think that's about it, yes. That type of mine, which is an anti, you know, to blow tracks off and that sort of thing.
Well, I was going to say, were these anti-personnel mines?
No, they were more likely anti-tank mines, actually. They certainly weren't anti-personnel. If they'd been anti-personnel, they would have shot these steel balls around all over the place. And the anti-personnel were usually activated by a tripwire.
Not by the pressure of a foot?
No, whereas these were pressure of foot or pressure of tracks or whatever. Germans had got the Teller mines, which were pretty effective. The trouble was, of course, with mines in the Desert War, that a lot of the British mines were what we called Egyptian pattern mines. Where they were manufactured, I don't know. But they were so unreliable that once they'd been put in the ground, nobody wanted to try and get them out again, because they were just as likely to go off when you were getting them out. At least you knew with the German mines that if you found a German mine and you took it out, the damn thing wouldn't explode on you because it had been badly put together. But with these EP pattern mines, which we used a great deal, they were very, very dicey things indeed to dig up once you'd actually put them in.
What about the Italian mines?
Italian mines, don't know very much about the Italian mines. I know their grenades were virtually useless, the little red grenades they used to throw around. I mean, you could almost catch them and throw them back, or hit them with a cricket bat if you've got one. But I think their mines were up to a fairly good standard. I would say that definitely the worst mines to dig up were our own, EP, Egyptian pattern, they were called. So there we are, after the reconnaissance on the 6th of September. On September the 9th, the battalion took over from the New Zealanders in the southwest corner of the Alamein line. Very noticeably, the New Zealanders were not only very efficient, but very friendly, went out of their way to be helpful. They were, in every way, they were first-class troops, you know. We moved in under cover of darkness, that is to say, B Company and C Company. And there were prepared positions for two rifle companies in this particular part of the Alamein line. And by dawn, the battalion was firmly in the toe of the Alamein line, took stock of our surroundings. On the left of us, we had the 6th Battalion, echeloned back and facing south. On the right, we had the Royal West Kents of the 44th London Division, Home Counties, I think, who had only very recently come out to the Middle East. I think possibly this was the very first time they'd ever been in any area where there was action. The 8th Battalion was responsible for a narrow front. That's a two-company front. Both companies were sited on the forward slopes. One company facing south and the other one facing south and west.
Was this then on the end of the Qatar pressure.
Yeah, well, yes, it, if you imagine, that's really what it, that's really what it looked like. The Katara Depression was down there to the south, and one company was facing that way. The other company was facing, as we say,
the other was facing western.
Yeah, that's right, facing south and west, and west being towards the Anger Depression. The Katara Depression was down to the south, in actual fact.
How wide was this front? You say it's a narrow front, so two companies wide. What sort of distance would it be?
Well, I think talking about the two companies would be occupying an area, I would have thought, of about 5,000 or 6,000 yards.
It's quite a wide front, really, to cover, isn't it?
Well, don't forget you've got two platoons up with each. Yes, it is, actually. It is.
Was it a World 55?
Oh, it was, yes. It was. Was fortified to the extent that there was a thick belt of mines called the Outer Circle, which protected the front of both companies. There was a second belt of mines called the Inner Circle, behind the two forward companies, and dividing the forward companies from the reserve companies and battalion headquarters. And on the two flanks were the Cheshire, the Vickers guns of the Cheshires, which were covering the Outer Circle minefield. So you've got minefield, two infantry companies, Vickers on the flanks, another minefield, and behind it, battalion headquarters and the reserve company.
What about the actual positions themselves, the infantry positions?
Well, we were immediately opposite a saucer-shaped feature called the Anger Depression. It was in front of the Outer Circle minefield, mainly opposite the right forward company, so it would be facing west, in fact. The nearest enemy, mostly Italian, were on the far side of this Anger Depression, and we reckon about 1,500 yards away from us. 1,500 yards sounds quite a lot, but it wasn't very far, really. It's less than a mile. The forward company positions were under continual observation by day. Now, the New Zealanders warned us about this. They said if you stick your heads up by day, you'll get shot at, because they've got an 88mm which picks up every movement. And that the best time for you to do any moving around is by night.
Presumably then you could see their positions, or did they have higher ground?
No, they did. We couldn't see their positions as well as they could see ours. I don't think it was you got this anger, this saucer between you, and they were on the far side. You could see them moving about as well as they could see us moving about, I think, yes. Of course our guns used to pick them off the same as the 88 used to pick our chaps off occasionally. But I think here again you've got to bring in this heat haze business. You could see damn all in the morning, and up until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was very difficult to see. Some days worse than others.
Were you in foxholes, or were you in more elaborate works?
What happened was that the two companies that were up there were B and C, and I was commanding B Company. There was practically no movement by day, and in fact it was much restricted in the rest of the battalion area. Patrols could only go out at night. Day patrols were quite impossible, and the troops lived underground by day. They literally were in their slit trenches all day. Any routine jobs were night. we had several killed and wounded in those forward company positions during September by this Italian sniping gun, which in fact was an 88, which we called, nicknamed Gucci. But tit for tat, the British gunners used to shell them. The gunner OPs were with us, and they brought down shell fire on any movement on in the enemy lines. The platoon positions were a continuous trench system. Reserve ammunition, food and water was kept in these positions. The men slept fully clothed, and we were only allowed to loosen our bootlaces at night. So you can imagine that socks got a bit high, and so did everything else. But night after night, to go to sleep in a slit trench, you know, with all your clothes on, including your boots, wasn't particularly comfortable. Each section had two men on watch at night, and it was not unusual for a man to do a spell of 4 hours before the dawn, and damn difficult to keep awake. Whether there was anything happening out there or not, it was very, very difficult. So always my sergeant major used to go around two or three times, and I used to go around two or three times, mainly to talk to the chaps and keep them awake and not let them feel that nobody else was. We didn't really go around not just to check up, but to give them a little bit of a morale uplift when they were stuck there with only a few yards very, very close to the enemy. If they happened to overcome a listening, one of our listening posts, which they did on one occasion, they were on top of you before you knew it.
How far out were your listening posts then?
Just in front of the outer circle minefield on the enemy side of the minefield gap.
What were they supposed to do if they heard anything coming?
Warn battalion headquarters.
Did they have a telephone?
By telephone. And I'll come to that bit in a bit, actually, in a bit, and tell you what happened with one of them. But during the day, there was only one sentry per section. The others slept or wrote letters in their trenches with ground sheets to shield them from the sun. You couldn't move around during the day. You could, and some people had to, but you were taking a risk. And so the only other alternative you had was to get in the bottom of the slit trench, blazing hot, with the sun blazing down on you, and cover yourself and have a ground sheet across the top of the trench, maybe held down by rocks on all four corners. And that was the only way you got any away from the sun.
This was similar to the Gazala line there, wasn't it?
We didn't have a continuous trench system there.
At Gazala?
No, not actually, not to the same extent that we did at Alamein. Alamein was just as much dug below ground level, everything, but more of a continuous trench system than it was at Gazala.
What was the layout of these trenches? Were they facing just towards the enemy, or did you have each platoon in a sort of redoubt with all
the defence? If I remember rightly, each platoon had its... you'd have two platoons up again and one back, and each of the forward platoons would have its own little area. The right-hand one of the 8th Battalion would be fairly close to the Cheshires, who were on that flank. The left-hand platoon of the 6th Battalion would be fairly close to the Cheshires on that flank. I don't think that the platoon areas, no, I'm sure they weren't joined together by trenches. They were self-contained, really. And, of course, as I think we said, they'd got water and food in there as well.
But did each platoon have a trench that could be defended from all sides? Or were they open to the back? Were they more open to the back than to the front? Was each platoon supposed to be able to defend itself on a 360-degree front?
Don't forget, we'd got the minefield behind us. We'd got the inner circle minefield behind us. I don't think the trench system was, in fact, designed for that. It was designed to cover the outer circle minefield and the enemy positions. If they'd broken through at the back, well, then you could have turned round in your slit trench and fired in that direction.
But the slit trench is really orientated towards...
Exactly. Towards the Anger Depression, basically, because that's where the threat would have come from.
Was there any barbed wire?
No.
Just mines and slit trenches?
You might have had some barbed wire across the minefield gaps, across our minefield gap. That's to say, when you go into the gap and when you come out of the gap, there would be Dannett wire probably at either end. You couldn't leave them absolutely open. You took the wire away when patrols went out and when they came back again, and then you put it back in position.
The Cheshires with their machine guns, how many machine guns would you have attached to the company?
A section, I would have thought. Probably two guns. Although we'd got...
So you say you'd got a Cheshire post at each end of your...
A section of machine guns on our right and a section of machine guns on the left of the 6th Battalion. I'd have thought that was either two guns, I should think. Because they had to look after all the infantry in the, you know, in 50 Div, the Cheshires. We only had the one machine gun outfit, actually.
Did you sight those, or did they sight themselves? Or
well...
Did they just have to go into trenches that were already there?
I think probably in this particular case they did, but generally speaking, the CO would decide where he wanted the vicar's support, and the company commander who was occupying that area would be told that the vicars are going to be there and there. If they weren't happy about what was allocated to